All right, looks good. Let's go.
Here we go. All right.
All right. So I was basically going, who knows when I'll see you again? Might make the best of it.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Well, every time I see Callie, I want to talk cashew. So talk cashew to me, baby. Talk cashew to me.
I'll share the nuts.
Sure, let's talk some nuts. I have a specific question. I saw you on, with pen and paper, drawing Merkle trees.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to solve a problem.
Yes.
Tell me about the problem and tell me about what you have in mind.
Okay, you want to go in real deep.
Yes, right, let's start deep.
Okay, so I'll start with...
Fuck the noobs.
Fuck the noobs, all right. Well, I'll try... No. I'll try to get the noobs in. So, simple concept. The way a cashew mint works is it issues eCash tokens as blind signatures and it gives out to the users. And then those tokens are at some point spent back to the mint. And so the mint has kind of, let's say, one major list. And those are the spent eCash tokens. Typically, this is a normal database. It's like a table. You put every single token into a table. And another way to organize the list, instead of an ordinary table, you can also organize it as a sparse Merkle tree. And the sparse Merkle tree is basically, you have a Merkle tree. Let's say you have all the possible eCash tokens in the world, like 32 byte, right?
Yeah.
It's like a massive space. And imagine them all in a line, starting from 0000 up until like 1111111, the 256 bit full ones. So this is all in a line. And if you organize them all in a line, then you can start to build a Merkle tree out of them.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a one-dimensional line in the bottom, and then you go up and up and up and up, and that makes a Merkle tree. And at the end of the day, you get one Merkle root, which is the top root of the Merkle tree. So you can think of the root of the Merkle tree, of the sparse Merkle tree, of all the spent eCash tokens a mint has ever seen, as like the state of the mint. So the Merkle root, the root hash at the top, says which tokens have ever been spent in that mint encoded in a single hash, right?
Yeah.
So once you do that, you have like a super compact representation of what the database of the mint looks like.
The state of the mint.
The state of the mint.
Yeah.
Like I say the state of the mint because that's the main thing that evolves over time.
Yeah.
So from time now to time now, you spend a token, I add it to the database, which I would insert in the bottom of this tree, and that changes all the hashes on the top, and then the Merkle root at the top changes, and that's the next state of the mint.
Yeah, maybe explain the minting spending
right
thing. Like you wanted to say, you said, yeah, let's bring in the noobs.
Okay. Come one step back.
So let's maybe take three steps back.
Okay.
So usually a mint has a Lightning gateway, and the idea is to have eCash on top of Bitcoin, and with Cashew, the awesome thing about Cashew, not only can you send Cashew tokens around, you also can just pay regular Lightning invoices. And the blindnet signatures that you mentioned, the awesome thing about that is the guy who runs the mint, which is basically the banker, doesn't see anything. Like who pays whom and who holds how much money, he doesn't see. That's what blindnet signatures brings.
So it achieves that basically through cryptography, but what you end up, as you already started explaining, is the simple idea is you send Bitcoin via Lightning to the mint, and the mint issues you eCash tokens.
Yeah.
And like if you want to go into that process a little bit more, the real process is I send you Bitcoin as a user, I send the mint Bitcoin, and with that I also give you I generate a random secret. It's called like the eCash secret, and I blind it. So it's kind of like an encryption. I blind it with an encryption key that only I know as a user, and I give that encrypted secret to you. And once you receive the Bitcoin on Lightning, the mint, it says, okay, I received the Bitcoin, and then I kind of sign that encrypted secret I sent to you, and I send it back. And we called it a blinded signature.
Yeah.
And the last step is now that I receive the blinded signature back as a user, I unblind it with that encryption secret from the first step. And now I get an unblinded signature, which is that eCash token itself. So that thing is a token. And I can now carry that. The mint doesn't know what that secret looks like, that this unencrypted signature looks like. It has never seen it before. But the Mint will be able to know in the future when I want to spend it again. So I can come back to the Mint and say, here's a blind signature, here's a secret. Look at the signature. You made that signature, Mint. And the Mint can verify, yes, this was me. But I don't remember which one of those users you were when you first created it. So at that point, when I come back to the Mint and want to spend that token, that's when I, when the Mint needs to insert that token into the database to prevent the same token from being spent again.
Yeah.
So the main goal or the main job of the Mint is essentially preventing double spending by remembering which tokens have been spent.
Keeping track of these tokens.
Yeah. Right. So
and so that's that lands on Mint state.
Yes.
Like Mint state is the issue you were trying to solve on with pen and paper with the Merkle tree.
Well, it goes a bit deeper because so now let's go back into Merkle trees. So for a normal Merkle tree, you can make something called an inclusion proof. So if I know an entry at the bottom of this tree and someone has the whole database, basically the Mint can give me the data I need to traverse from that entry that I know up until the top. So I can ask the Mint, so I know this one entry that I just added to your database. Can you give me like the parent or the sibling of the level above? And then the sibling of the level above, and sibling of the level above, so on and so forth, until you reach the very top of the hash. And with that data, that
and the neat thing about that is you don't have to look at everything. You just look at one branch of the Merkle tree, basically.
Right.
So it's very inexpensive to do.
You just need like a couple of entries of the Merkle tree for me as a user to be able to verify that hash that you have at the very top of the Merkle tree is actually corresponding to the entry that I just gave you.
This is so the Mint has your token.
Right. This is called an inclusion proof. So I can prove that this entry is part of the Merkle tree without knowing the entire tree. And this is super powerful. And now when you go to a sparse Merkle tree, which is like, you know, the one that is even bigger, I just tried to really, like in a short way, explain it in the beginning. But essentially it's, again, a Merkle tree, but just organized a little bit differently. But that one also allows you to create something called an exclusion proof.
Mm-hmm.
So you can prove that an entry is not in the database. Mm-hmm. And an exclusion proof in the context of like an eCash token, where the Mint carries this entire tree as the state, an exclusion proof proves that the token that I have hasn't been spent yet. So, and why would that be interesting? Now, the idea you saw me sketching on a piece of paper was just basically trying to think a little ahead, although all the thoughts that I have are not complete yet, like it doesn't work fully in my head yet. But imagine the Mint would kind of commit to the Merkle root on the Bitcoin blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really work on the Bitcoin blockchain because we cannot do Merkle proofs on Bitcoin yet because we would need like an opcode like opcat or something. But we could do it, for example, on Arcade or other like more expressive scripting languages on top of Bitcoin. But the idea is that if the Mint would say, this is the current state of the Mint, and I imprint it onto the Bitcoin blockchain, and I add a script on top of it which says, any user who can prove that they have an eCash token that is valid, which was signed by the Mint, and can prove that the eCash token is not included in that Merkle tree, so with an exclusion proof, might be able to, let's say, unilaterally withdraw from the Mint. So you could build a script that lives on-chain that the Mint uses to manage its reserves that says anyone who can produce this exclusion proof can withdraw from the reserve of the Mint. And why is that interesting? Because it, at least in theory, opens like a way for a unilateral exit for eCash mints.
Mm-hmm.
So even if the Mint goes offline, even if the Mint doesn't want to cooperate with you, you can just go on-chain and say, here's the exclusion proof, give me the Bitcoin back.
All right, awesome. I'll go three steps back again. So Cashew is awesome, mints are awesome. The two main issues, one you just mentioned, which is basically a full, like, I don't want to call it rug pull, like Mint goes offline. Like it's because I said rug pull once and you objected and it were basically it's like a DDoS. It's like denial of service. It's like the Mint cannot rug pull you. That's where the blinded part comes in, because you can't be targeted. The Mint doesn't know about you. Mm-hmm. But the Mint can go offline, and then you can't access your tokens, which means you can't, you know, send
I want to make that a little precise, just for completeness, is the Mint can rug pull everyone by stealing the Bitcoin in the current paradigm.
We'll come to that later.
But
we'll come
to that later. Rug pull you specifically.
I'll ask you about the TES stuff later.
Right. Yeah.
But so the two main criticisms is basically right now, the Mint, let's make it three. The Mint can go offline, the Mint can rug pull you, and the Mint can inflate.
Right.
Right?
Fractional reserve.
So to simplify, there's like inflation risk and there's rug pull risk.
Right.
And you're trying to tackle both of them.
Right.
And so the exclusion proofs of the sparse Merkle trees?
Yes.
Yes?
That would be kind of, if you add unilateral exit to the system, then you kind of solve almost the entire problem. If you could, like, if you could couple that on-chain anchoring of the Mint state tightly to the Mint's operation itself, you might be able to solve both problems at the same time. So I call it the slow rug pull and the fast rug pull, actually. So the slow rug pull would be
inflation.
The inflation risk, where the Mint prints tokens slowly at the side. No one really notices. Yeah. The Mint sometimes withdraws from the Mint itself. So the Mint operator pretends to be a user and withdraws some. And then at the end, like the last guy still holding the bags is the one who's rug pulled. And then the other one is the fast rug pull is the Mint just says, you know, fuck this, I'm closing down, taking the Bitcoin, going to Cuba.
Yeah.
That would be the fast one. So if you could add unilateral exit to the to Cashew, and if you could guarantee that the Mint honestly represents all the issued tokens and the burned tokens on the blockchain, you could solve, in theory, both of these problems. Again, asterisk, this thought is not fully complete in my head yet.
Yeah.
But I think it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, I see. So, all right, let's switch gears to the TE stuff that I just alluded to.
Yeah.
So the issue right now is also, or maybe describe the problem that running a Cashew Mint in a trusted execution environment would solve.
So if you run a Cashew Mint on an ordinary server, then you as the operator of the Mint generate the private keys for the eCash itself, so the eCash issuance, that is the private keys to make blind signatures, which creates eCash tokens, that creates the supply.
Yeah. The key and to the Mint.
The key to
the minting.
And the same key can also be used for the Bitcoin on-chain reserve. So we can think of it like as a single key that is used for both operating the Mint and for securing the Bitcoin.
Okay.
So if you run that server on a normal server, obviously you can just SSH into a thing and then get the private key, rug everyone, and run away.
Yeah.
So a TEE is called a Trusted Execution Environment, sometimes called an enclave, but it's essentially a server where you as the operator don't have access to the server itself. So it's like setting up a server in some like a full self-driving mode.
Yeah.
You start the server, you install, let's say, CDK Mint, the Mint implementation that we have for Cashew, when you start it, it generates the private keys for the first time.
Mm.
But from that moment on, you never have access to to the server again.
Yeah.
So if you start the server with a verified version of CDK, where you can like verify on GitHub, look at the code, and see it does exactly what it says it will do, then at that point, the Mint just keeps running. And theoretically, no one should be able to break into the Mint and steal the Bitcoin, because the operator himself never sees the private keys. Yeah. It's generated inside in a sealed box.
Yeah, same idea as the secure enclaves we have on our phones.
Right, secure enclaves we have on our phones. Some hardware wallets have that. Bitcoin hardware wallets have that. There's like a bunch of shitcoins that run on the same premise.
Yeah.
Essentially, hiding away the private keys from the guy who's actually operating the server.
Yeah.
So why is that very useful for the Cashew case is because now you can essentially rule out that the fast rug risk and the slow rug risk of the operator, because the operator doesn't have access to these private keys.
Yeah.
He cannot mess up with it. And the nice thing is about secure enclaves is you don't have to, like, trust me, bro, the operator is actually running a real version of CDK, but the client himself can connect to that server and then get, like, a signature from the actual hardware of that server that says, I am running this software and nothing else. Yeah. So you can, before you connect to the Mint, before you send Bitcoin to the Mint, you can verify, this is CDK, I've reviewed it on GitHub, this is the right, like,
yeah, yeah, this is the release, this is the tag, it was a signed release, and so on, and it's running exactly that code, and it has that hash.
And this is amazing, because, like, it reduces the risk by a lot. So it's great for the users, because users know that the Mint operator cannot steal the Bitcoin, the Mint operator cannot print more eCash, but it's also great for the Mint operator because
plausible deniability
creates this beautiful scenario where the Mint operator can actually say, I have no access to the Bitcoin. I can not run away with them. I have no access. I don't have unilateral access to the to the reserves of the Mint.
Yeah. So what some people might know about is, like, with VPN providers and those types of services, if a government comes knocking and says, give me all the user data, or also for encrypted messaging, encrypted emails and so on, what you're describing is what some of those guys are already doing. They can literally say, I don't have any user data. I can't do anything. I can't give you anything.
Well, this is on top of the privacy that the eCash Mint provides you anyway. So the Mint itself, the whole blind signature part, already gives you incredible privacy, whether it's on TE or not.
Yes.
But on top of that, you can even, like, if the police comes knocking, they wouldn't be able to get the private keys and take the Bitcoin, for example. Yeah. Even the protection for a hacker, there's also another thing, like an independent risk that you have is even if you're a good guy, you want to run
you get hacked, someone gets the private key somehow, and drug pulls everyone.
There's always a possibility that someone breaks into your server and just starts printing Bitcoin, for example. So you can also reduce that risk basically to zero by running it in an TE environment.
All right, fantastic. How far along are we with this?
So the Mint, we have Mints running in TE, so we are there, it works. I'm, like, one of only 2-3 people who have tried it so far because it's not ready to roll out yet, but we've shown it works. It works great with on-chain Bitcoin. One complication is...
So instead of a Lightning gateway, you have an on-chain gateway.
Right, you cannot really run a Lightning node inside. There is a beautiful project called Lexi. There's actually a technically huge achievement who have managed to run also Lightning node inside a TE, but it's nothing like that you just do on the side job, right? So whereas on-chain, if the Mint is backed with on-chain, it's very simple. You have a BDK wallet, you generate a private key, you just talk to the blockchain, that's it. Like, it's super simple to run an on-chain wallet inside an enclave. Yeah. It's not so easy to run with Lightning, but that's not a big problem. Like, we can we can still find solution for Lightning that still works. But with you can think of it like the easiest way, the simplest way is having a on-chain wallet that backs the Mint. And so that works. I've sent on-chain Bitcoin to a server where I would never be able to take out the Bitcoin again, except if I send back eCash to the server and withdraw.
And you go through the actual, is it called melting actually?
Through the actual melting process? Yeah, we call it minting during creation minting and melting during destruction of eCash.
Yeah, yeah. So no funny business, just the official path to get the sats out again. You mentioned briefly before with the exclusion proofs, that it would be possible on Spark using ArcScript, right?
Yes.
Or tell me more about that. That's still something I barely understand.
So I said Arcade because Arcade is one of the two Arc implementations that we have. So there's Second called Bark, and then there's Arcade from the Arcade guys, and they both take very different approaches on how to implement Arc. I would say Bark really focuses on payments and Bitcoin, and Arcade tries to build something like a virtual machine that can run in an Arc-style system, and they want to enable basically all kinds of computation that you could run. Instead of running Bitcoin script, you could run other scripts that can be enforced on the Bitcoin blockchain eventually through that unilateral exit path of Arc.
When you say all kinds of computation, like, what level of computation are we talking? Are we talking Turing complete?
I cannot really answer that question because I haven't looked that deep into it, but I would assume that it's Turing complete because, you know, it can essentially do what Ethereum could also do, all sorts of computation. And that's the nice thing about it. It doesn't change Bitcoin, but it still allows you to make those complex computation. Why it's necessary for this particular problem is the exclusion proof itself. So on the Bitcoin blockchain, you cannot execute an inclusion proof or an exclusion proof for Merkle tree.
You mentioned we would need OPCAT.
You mentioned we need OPCAT. Yes. Yeah. So with OPCAT, we could do it on chain. But it would be extremely expensive to still just do it on chain. It's like a kilobyte of data just to prove an inclusion or exclusion proof for a 256-bit deep Merkle tree. So that's a bunch of money that you would have to spend for a unilateral exit, whereas on Arcade, it's essentially for free. So you can do it very fast, very cheap, and then unilaterally exit from Arcade back to the Bitcoin on-chain.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. Given all that, what's your best guess for the next, I know it's impossible to say, but for the next, like, and in the world of that we're living in right now, I was about to say, you know, near-term future, 6 to 12 months, but that's like, you know, that's like super futuristic. 12 months out is like we'll be living in a different world.
Exactly. I have no idea what's going to happen in 12 months from now on.
But in terms of like what do you want to ship next, so to speak, or what are the people that you work with that are all pushing this forward?
Yes.
Where's the puck going? Like, so, how do you see it evolve?
A bunch of super smart people have been nerd-snapped by this, which I love. Like, awesome. It's beautiful to see that there's a bunch of really like people I really respect in the Bitcoin space who have contributed brain power to this idea. Yeah. Luke Childs has done it.
Yeah, yeah.
Cooks has also been nerd snapped by this topic.
I think so Waxwing also looked at it, right?
Waxwing was also super interested in it when I explained it to him. But there are a few challenges still remaining. So the TEE part, we solved it. CDK works, amazing team.
Yeah, proof of concept is there. Like, we know that this works and we know that this will work.
But for example, there are still some risks remaining. The biggest one is you shut the mint off. So there's still this issue that even though the operator cannot steal the Bitcoin, they can still just turn off the mint. Basically, if they don't pay their Amazon bills, then the mint goes offline. Yeah. What happens then? There is one very simple and elegant idea that I really like about how this can be managed is now not like instead of just storing the funds of the mint in a simple on-chain address, you could store it in a little bit more complicated script of on-chain, which says the mint can control the on-chain funds except if you wait 2 weeks, then another multisig quorum, like a third party.
So you have a time sig triggered.
Right. So like if the mint goes offline, you wait 2 weeks and then another entity then gets control of the Bitcoin and they could then help, let's say, the users of the mint that just went offline, they could help them to
take the latest state that we know and tally it up. And
exactly. So a requirement for that would be that this other third party needs access to that database of the mint because they need to know which eCash has been spent already.
Yeah.
And so if you then, after 2 weeks, the mint is offline, after 2 weeks, you go to the third party and you say, here's an eCash token I haven't spent yet. Check your database. They're like, okay, this is true. The mint is offline. Here's your, you know, you get your Bitcoin back.
I see. Awesome, awesome. Mm-hmm. Ah, that's cool. That's a good use of time locks and multiple spending paths and those kind of things. Fantastic. All right. What else? So those were the two biggest question marks for me, where I was like, if I have 20 minutes to pick your brain, that's what I'm going to ask. But lots of other things have happened. Like, obviously, there was, we're still at the Freedom Forum, AOS convergence happened before.
Yes.
What are some other exciting things that are currently happening on the Cashew side?
So one thing that is like a pretty big change that we're working on right now is we're changing our entire crypto. So I'm sorry for everyone listening right now, we're breaking it again. But we feel like as long as BlackRock hasn't bought Cashew, we can still make changes basically. So what we're doing right now is currently we're using SegP 256K1 as the curve for Cashew. It's very simple cryptographic scheme invented by David Wagner in 1996. It's funny because he invented it because David Chaum himself, he patented RSA blind signatures.
Yeah.
And because no one was able to use that, David Wagner just used elliptic curve paradigm to make blind signatures.
So why do you think these people like patents so much? Like, you know,
It is terrible. I mean, Schnorr is a good example because Satoshi couldn't use Schnorr signatures up until like he was gone, and then we could implement Schnorr signatures. Why they do it, I don't know. I think they live in this sugar world reality where they think like this idea, if I protect it, I can make money off it. and others won't be able to do it. But, you know, I'm absolutely not a big fan of patents at all. I would rather want to live in a world where ideas cannot be protected by intellectual property. I
don't believe. Great book against intellectual property.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I think like we need to tear down this entire system of intellectual property. I think information wants to be free, should be free, and not like the idea itself isn't the main important part, it's the execution.
Yeah, in the cypherpunk future, like where we are going, we don't need no roads, so the roads are intellectually property rights.
100%. So anyway, so we used that scheme from David Wagner, which is a very simple blind signature scheme, and it has a couple of problems that, you know, for example, the biggest one is it is technically speaking not a blind signature scheme, it is a blind MAC scheme. And a MAC scheme is message authentication code, for the crypto nerds out there who understand. Is a signature scheme is defined as you can verify the signature with a public key. And in Cashew, or with any MAC scheme, you can verify a signature only with a private key itself. So if I, like, as a third party, you would not be able to verify if a Cashew token is really signed by the mint or not, because you don't have the private keys of the mint. And for this, we have used a construct called DLEQ proofs. It's a discrete log equality proof. And it's like a, we're doing yoga to make something very simple possible, and it's not the ideal solution. So we've been building way too complicated solutions for a very simple problem. That should have been just verify the signature with the public key, done. But we don't have that because we chose this very simple scheme. Now, we are tired of it and we want to go to the next level. And the next level is a pairing-based crypto called BLS signatures, which are also very simple math, very well studied. It is not the Bitcoin curve, but it's a different curve. And with this new crypto, we'll be able to verify eCash also with public keys. That makes everything that I just explained with like the third party helping you to offboard and so on and so forth way, way simpler. So at the end of the day, what we will have is new crypto that is simpler and easier to verify publicly. And it will allow us to build way more quicker these solutions that I just
explained. But like you said, that's obviously a breaking change. And so what version are we going to be at with the new cryptographic scheme?
It's going to be like the second version of the crypto, but we have prepared an upgrade path already for these kind of changes. So it's not going to affect your experience at all. In the best case, you will not even notice anything. So we have something called key sets in Cashew. And key sets are the set of private keys or the set of public keys that the mint uses to sign these tokens. And from our perspective, we just add one more version to this key set. And in the next version, you will use a different curve with different crypto. Again, from your perspective as user, nothing really changes. From our perspective, everything gets a little simpler.
Yeah, awesome, awesome. What's the timeline on this switch and on this upgrade?
Oh, we've already built it. We just need to press the merge button, but we want to do it like in synchrony, so we're going to upgrade all the wallets that we're maintaining and then press on the merge button all together, and then hopefully people will start deploying these new key sets in mainnet, and then we'll see hopefully all the wallets just seamlessly continuing to work. So I would say 2 weeks.
All right, 2 weeks TM, fantastic.
Yes.
You say you've already built it, but that's a bold-faced lie.
No.
Because...
Go to GitHub.
No. What I mean is like your agents have built it for you. So that's something else I want to dig into with you just for a couple minutes.
Yes, let's go there. But I want to be fair and, you know, we have a whole team of people working on this.
Sure,
so
sure.
When I say we built it, then I don't only mean my agents, but I mean the agents of my colleagues. Who
I was about to say, but everyone is using agents by now,
yes,
including Ege. Shout out Ege.
Shout out
last Ege. Last man who fell. Last thread coder.
Yes.
That got converted recently,
so,
I've heard.
Yeah, we've been pushing extremely hard on this. So I've been like on this whole agentic coding thing from day zero, basically. And I saw very early, as everyone else, that this is going to be the only way that we're going to work. So all of us in the team are super AI-based. We make a big difference between, you know, what is critical code that a human must edit or at least review thoroughly. And then there's a bunch of code that is just wallet side, UI, business logic stuff, that is where you know you cannot break anything because the underlying library does everything for you. And everything like the sugar coating, we just do it completely in AI.
The old paradigm still holds, which is don't roll your own crypto, right? And it's it goes further than that, like don't vibe your own crypto.
Exactly.
So yes. The more the things change, the more they stay the same. But talk me through your setup. Like, how does it compare to Marty Malmö's setup, for example? Which to me is like the, you know, other people are merely experiencing AI psychosis. He was born in it, molded by it. Like, he was running around with the laptop open at all times. Absolutely. Basically strapped, well, strapped to him.
Shout out to Marmy as well. He's an inspiration to me. But my setup is changing all the time. So first of all, I have no allegiance to any of the providers or models at all. I see them as like arbitrary, exchangeable products. So I'll use any model at any given time. I don't make a difference between an American model and a Chinese model. I don't care. I run local models as well, and I wish they were better, but at this point in time, they're still not useful as coding agents, so you need to go to one of the providers.
Yeah.
My setup personally is I use OpenRouter, which means I can use all the models all the time. I don't need to, you know, select one and just keep that. My life happens in OpenCode. So this is a coding harness that runs in your terminal. I spend most of my days in OpenCode inside there. And I've developed like many different workflows over the year or, you know, the months, in the recent months. What I really am fascinated by these days, though, is kind of how can I get even better? What does it mean to be a really good agentic coder? What are the tricks and tips that make it work better? So I'll make one example that I learned from Peter Steinberger, for example, is, and this completely blew my mind, although this is such a simple fact, is he said, when you watch your agent code a function and the agent gives the function a simple name that you don't like, then don't tell the agent to change the function name, because, you know, just because you like it doesn't mean it's the better name to choose, because you're going to kill that agent and you're going to create a new agent tomorrow that is supposed to find that function again.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to think basically like them. You submit to the agent and say, okay, agent, like whatever you think is right, probably it's the best way, because tomorrow another agent will have to continue your work.
Yeah.
So these are like, this is one simple factoid that you pick up during this entire crazy development. So what I'm really like trying to dig every one single person that I meet who's a coder using AI is, what are your tricks? What are the things that you've discovered? Because I believe we're in a special time where there is no written knowledge, no systems, no formalizations. It is basically like from mouth to mouth. We're back to the Middle Ages where knowledge spreads through colloquial, you know, conversations.
Yeah.
And this is crazy to me because it's already like a $1 trillion industry where the smallest optimizations of how you work with AI could have massive impact on your output, but we have no.
And also on your costs. Also on your costs.
Also on
like
your costs.
One form of retard maxing is token maxing.
Right.
And I see a lot of people do that, just like spending endless amounts of tokens.
Yeah,
and like
another one is bullshit. Like, it just makes sense to understand how these machines work. For example, what I see noobs do a lot is they start a conversation with an agent and then they go like in one direction and figure like that's not the right direction, and they tell the agent, no, that's not what I mean, just do something else.
Yeah.
And like in that case, what I see is you're loading up the context with bullshit that the agent doesn't need.
Yeah.
So instead of trying to navigate the agent back to where you want to go, just kill the agent, create a new one, like make a better prompt from the first one, and try to one-shot everything that you're doing. That's my goal.
I'll tell you two of my tricks.
Yes, please.
So, as you know, I'm a big fan of dialogical development and dialogue in general.
Yeah.
And like you said, we're in the age of dialogue right now. Mouth, word of mouth kind of pro tips and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, like the whole idea of sovereign engineering itself was to build something that evolves around and revolves around dialogue. And so what I do to build up context is I always basically use the Socratic method before I start. So fresh session, new context window, and it's like basically, let's say on the search I wanna basically modify how, whatever, like some substitutions that the search does. It's like, are we doing any substitutions in our search? Uh-huh. And then it's like, oh yeah, here's how we do it. And it's like, okay, what are the things that we substitute? Yeah, here's the things we substitute. Would it make sense to add like these two? And then, yeah, it would make sense. And then, okay, let's add it. What else do we need to do? And then I always end on questions also. And one is like, what's something that we should refactor? Mm-hmm. On the code we just touched, on the branch we're on, what's something that we, like low-hanging fruit, that we should refactor? Give me the top three.
Awesome.
Give me the top three. I always do that. And if I disagree, like if all top three are bullshit, we don't refactor at all.
Yeah, you know you're finished.
Yeah,
once
exactly.
The agent only gives you
bullshit. And so I have macros for all of these and all of these questions. And so on the conceptual side as well, it's like, you know, give me the top five of ways of how we could do this.
This is what often what I do is I let the agent implement something complicated. And at the end of the whole implementation, even if it works, I ask it, now that you've done it, what would you have done differently?
Yeah.
Because now it has seen all the context.
Exactly.
Only after doing it, it knows what the mistakes were that it did.
Yeah, just like
so
us.
So it's like, oh, now if I would do it again, I would probably factor this function a little bit differently and put this there. Yeah. And it's like, okay, just do it.
Yeah.
And it just fixes the problem that it just created by itself.
Yeah, I do that a bunch as well. And what I work with is multiple models and a fresh context window or another agent, those kind of things.
I think this is something that, you know, everyone should realize listening is context window is precious resource.
Yeah.
You should not fill it with useless stuff.
Yeah.
Because the models even get worse at doing math, like basic simple math. If you ask an agent what's 3 times 5, it will answer that question with a higher probability correctly in the beginning of the context window than at the end. So if you fill it with a bunch of bullshit before and then ask a math question, it makes more mistakes. So this is something to understand. You keep it as short as possible and create like the... You essentially like need to help a newborn baby to catch up to the thing every single time. And maybe that's also one of the biggest optimizations that we could do in these harnesses, which because I spend so much time just explaining the same thing over and over. Like, we're in a project, we're building this thing, we're currently in this feature, and this is what we've done so far.
Yeah.
And it's like, get back to me when you understand what I'm talking about. It comes back, and it's like, okay, I'm ready, now we execute.
Yeah, I mean, I think what a lot of people are working on right now is exactly these memory systems that will just like keep certain bits of context over sessions and will have like an easy way to access the memory and like something that's better. Like obviously OpenClaw went the way of MD files and but there is OpenClaw plugins already that use, you know, vector databases and stuff that kind of makes a little more sense. And I think what we were just talking before, right? Like lots of people have their OpenClaws and so on. And what I was explaining is like what I found for me, what works best for me is like if you have multiple projects, one agent per project, and then like if you have one, I use OpenClaw myself. If you have one agent for every single side project, every little thing you have, then the context and the memory and everything and the tools as well builds up over time, and that works wonders. Like that's it's so much better than having one assistant that does all of your 6 projects
so like
at the same time.
Much more aggressive compartmentalization of it, and you know, all the things that you let your agent do, they influence all the other things that you wanted to do. And because context is so precious, they're not able to do everything at once.
Yeah.
So it basically makes it worse on everything else.
Yes, exactly. And that's exactly what I wanted to mention, because from the cognitive science perspective, we know that there is a inherent trade-off relationship between being a generalist and a specialist. And so you can't be both things at the same time. And so what you want to have is you want to have your specialists, and maybe you want to have one big model, overarching generalist that knows a lot about cashew, that knows a lot about whatever, you know, Lightning, Arc, Bitcoin, and so on, and all those kind of things, or elliptic curves and cryptography and so on. But on the confusion part you mentioned, I think is really important, because if you want to stuff everything in one brain, so to speak, if you want to stuff everything in one, just like you want to stuff everything in one person, you know, like not even Elon can do absolutely everything. It's like that's just not how the world works. That's just not how cognitive structures work. Cognitive structures can't work that way. And I think, like, everyone who's, like, deep in the rabbit hole, I would highly encourage everyone who studied just a little bit of cognitive science and how the brain works and how, you know, we as humans do these kind of things. Because you will, that's what the AI people are figuring out right now, you have certain trade-off relationships that you just, you can't, like, no matter how much computer throw at it, you can't fix it. Mm-hmm. You will never have a model that is as good as on a specialized task as a specialized model.
Yes, but it's interesting because we are still in that paradigm, though. Like, if you zoom out, not from a user's perspective, but I mean from the Frontier Labs perspective, that their bet still is that the generalist scales more, or it makes more sense to create one big generalist than multiple specialists, basically.
Yeah.
So, and it's an open question. It's really an open question that no one can answer so far, and there's trillions of dollars betting on this question, is whether there should be like one GPT that does everything, or, and you can see Google already moving a little bit away from that target, saying, maybe we need a special model just for medicine. Maybe we need a special model just for writing. Mm-hmm. But whereas other frontier labs just say, like, we have one big model, it can do everything, and it increases its ability in all these different areas at the same time. But we really don't know whether it would have made sense, for example, to create like one coding agent that does nothing but coding and excel at this single task, whereas you know, being worse than others.
Not all, like, what the cognitive scientists would say about this, and at least those that I respect, is that not all skills transfer to other domains. Some skills transfer to other domains, but let me give you a very simple example. Like, if you are if you're a world class baseball player, you have a really good baseball swing, and you know how to ruin your baseball swing. You start playing tennis. Those things are in a trade-off relationship with each other. You can't be a world-class baseball player and a world-class tennis player at the same time, because the nuances of your baseball swing will get ruined by how much more you will train tennis and so on.
This is exactly the conundrum that the labs are into, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
so they'll face reality.
Start teaching the LLM to be a better writer, for example, and becomes a worse coder at the same time.
Yeah, that's how it works.
It's one of the things that you know, the lore of GPT-4o. Is beautiful, because, like, there are still people being completely degenerate and wishing back GPT-4o.
Yeah, because it's sycophantic. It loves you so much.
Extremely sycophantic. People love that model. Yeah. Like, they, the number of AI psychosis generated by that model is way higher than, for example, GPT-5.5 or the 5 series, because the 5 series is, like, super dry, gives you short answers, it's on point, and it's better at completing tasks, is better at coding, but it's not as engaging as the other one. So OpenAI needed to answer that question. It's an economic question for them, because what they actually want is to get as many users as possible.
Yeah.
But what they, you know, if you make it more engaging on a narrative side, conversational side, it becomes a worse coder. Whereas the coders say, like, I want that model for coding. Like, what are you guys doing? I don't want, like, a novel to come out of the thing. So they need to make that decision. They lean towards, seems like they leaned towards more the application, the professionals, you know, GPT-5.5 is a clear.
I mean, coding is what pays the bill right now, right?
That is true, but you know, there are like, I don't know the numbers. I don't want to guess on a podcast, but like
it's a dialogue, not a podcast.
I wouldn't even guess on a dialogue. A very large portion of the world uses LLMs. It's an incredible, like, it's the fastest technology in history that has been spreading. So many people just use it for conversation. Like, most people don't code.
Absolutely, but they are not the paying bunch usually. I think the from the economic side, we'll see how it shakes out. I think it's still an open question how these things will in the end be able to monetize.
Do you think the addiction for a coder is stronger than for a conversational person?
I mean, people end up marrying their chatbots right now, and actually divorcing their husbands and marrying the chatbots. So I'm not sure if I'm brave enough to answer the question. But on a kind of enterprise side, large software companies are willing to pay a lot for.
I've never seen any product so far where an individual is is willing to spend $200 a month to get access to a cloud service.
Yeah.
And we know people who have five of these accounts at the same time. Like some people spend $1,000 per month to get
and
as
in
much
Silicon Valley, those numbers are way higher. So
token like, maxing.
Yeah, token maxing. As I said before, I think it's a form of retard maxing right now.
Should we also talk like about beyond LLMs?
Yeah, what I think, let's hit the world models. So, I love it.
Okay, so I believe LLMs are kind of a scam in a sense. I mean, they're obviously extremely useful. I will keep using them forever and so on. But what the AI companies are forced to convince us of is that this is like the best of the best and this is the crown jewels of AI. And there are many people, especially doing AI research, who believe that LLMs are not the end of the answer. One of the biggest problems of LLMs are that they're essentially just token prediction machines. So they take a set of tokens and they predict the next token. That's all they do. And everything that they've trained on is language-based. So it is fascinating for me that language encodes so many truths about reality that you can extract almost things like emotion from language, sometimes even like how the world really works. But they
and just to bring one example, just to drive home that point, because I think when you hear that, some people will think, oh, that's all we do as well. And that's completely untrue, because when you start to learn to ride a bike, you don't use words.
No, absolutely not.
It's a different thing. Learning that 2 + 2 = 4 or the Eiffel Towers in Paris, that's what we call propositional knowing. And there is other types of knowing, like knowing how to ride a bike, which is very, very different, which is something that LLMs can't do.
Everyone who has a child understands this, because you watch your child learning its motor skills and being able to control its limbs and being, balancing, throwing things, catching things. None of this has anything to do with words. So we know that there's a large category of knowledge and skills in the world that are important for the world, have nothing to do with next token prediction.
Yeah.
And people plug LLMs into robots these days. Like there are robots where someone just basically pulls an LLM into the robot and says, if you output this JSON, if you want to move the arm to the left, output that JSON if you want to move it to the right. And the LLM, does something, but it has no conception of what the joints are of the robot, how things will react in your action, as a reaction to your action, and so on. So another category that a lot of people are focusing on right now is something called world models. And Jan LeCun is one of the proponents of this. And there is a model category called JEPA models and joint embedding predictive architecture, if I remember correctly. And they work on a completely different premise, and I think it's worth explaining here a little. So what a world model does, and you will hear that buzzword a lot these days. So you I just want to propose, just ignore it when you hear it in many contexts, because it's used wrongly. It has a specific academic meaning, and this is what it means. So a world model is essentially a model that is trained on action conditions. So what does it mean? The input to a world model is most of the time, for example, a video stream. So you can think of it, for example, a robot arm. And you film the robot arm over a long time, where it makes like movements of the robot arm. You just film it with a camera and you record the actions of the robot arm. So it says joint goes to the left, upper arm goes up, and so on and so forth. And what you do is you train a neural network where you input the image plus the action that the robot does, and then you force it to predict the next image, so to speak. So to be correct, it's not the image, but it's an embedding of the image, like an abstract version of it, but that's not really the most important point here. The important point is that you train data plus action leads to next state of data.
Yeah.
Or world, current world state plus action is the next world state. And when you force a neural network to learn to predict what the action in this current state will produce as a next state in the world, you force it to learn the underlying rules of the world. And that's why it's called a world model. So what people see is, when you take the example of a robot arm, you embed the image of, like, the video recording of the robot arm plus the joint actions. After doing this for a long time, you can find that the model starts to encode physical laws, like Newton's conservation of momentum, energy conservation.
Yeah.
It encodes gravity. Like, it starts coming up with the real physical laws of the world that it interacts in, because that's the only way to predict what the outcome of its action would be. And so this is super cool, because it allows us to build AI systems that can actually plan ahead. So instead of having an LLM that needs to hallucinate what will happen when I move my arm, this is forced to predict what the outcome of the action will be. So this is super useful for robotics these days, for self-driving cars and so on. But I believe that we will make more and more use of this in like other modalities, like maybe controlling your desktop computer or any kind of like where the model is forced to make an action.
Yeah. And since we're talking about robotics, you also have an empirical way to see if your prediction turned out to be true or not. And you're actually in touch with reality. This is, I think, important to point out, because my main criticisms of LLMs right now, or one of them, is that they are two steps removed from reality. It's like they are working on data that is one step removed from reality itself. It's like written text.
Human-generated text that was from observation of the world.
Exactly. And then you like the models are actually just a bunch of numbers, which are again one step removed from the actual data. And so LLMs are two steps removed from reality and are actually not in touch in reality and cannot be. And that's kind of the point that the cognitive scientists have made. Like, if we want to bridge that gap, we have to embody the cognition itself. Like we are embodied cognitive machines, basically, mm-hmm. if you want to use that term. Mm-hmm. Beings, if you want to be less mechanical about it. And so we need to put brains into robots and let them be in touch with reality and learn, like, about the world like children.
Yes, this is how to do it. This is really how to do it. Like, at least this is one of the ways how you can make that happen. And the nice thing about this is that the data is almost limitless, because right now we already reached a point with LLMs where the corpus, we've talked about this before, is already fully used. Like, there is no more text in the world that hasn't been used for
LLMs
already.
You have to make up new training data on the spot.
Yes, and like the most of the text generated these days is AI generated, and it's like a big no-no to put the AI generated text back into the LLM, because that's going to just collapse.
But that's what's happening. So, and it's also, just to make the point, because I put out on Nostr, like, I just shitpost still all the time, and I wrote it like over and over again, like, taste and values, and like, taste and values. No one knew what it means. What it means is, like, what data to generate, what data to focus on depends on your taste and values. And like, US versus China and so on, and like, we talk about research taste, so it all leads back to taste and values. And the thing about reality itself is, like, it's actually reality. Your taste and values don't matter. So if you know what I'm trying to say?
Right, yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, like a robot that is free to move in the world, for example, can just like move as long as the battery dies or the robot dies. You can learn from any experience. Yeah. If you can observe what you're doing, and if you know that you're doing that, that is enough to train a world model. The cool thing about it is world models are like, I don't know the number, but I've trained them on my own laptop, so I know how hard it is to generate an LLM. It's like basically impossible to do something useful on your laptop with a single graphics card, but you can train a world model on a single graphics card. It works. So it opens up a possibility of AI that can do lifelong learning.
Yeah.
You could put it in a robot. You could put this machine that I just explained into a robot with a single GPU, and the robot would literally, while, you know, it would be born stupid, and while moving around in the world, falling over, getting up again, trying to grab a glass, grabbing wrong, grabbing right this time, slowly learn, oh, this is how gravity works. Oh, this is how my joints actually work. Every time I do this, then, you know, the glass actually, it can be lifted from my arm. So all these things the robot would learn. And even, you know, once it breaks the arm, for example, the actuators change their properties during use because they get older and so on. It would be able to adapt in real time to the new conditions.
Yeah.
And then getting back to the brain, this is how the brain works. So I think of this in a simplified view. The LLM is your prefrontal cortex. It is the thing that generates language, planning. It's really good at long-term horizon. It knows, like, if the human tells me, do this, then it can reason about, like, why would I do this? Is this ethically good? Should I do it? Blah, 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 blah. All this, like, stream of consciousness that a robot can generate. But as soon as it needs to move around, It could activate something like
the animal brain.
And yeah, this is like the cerebellum in the back of your brain, which is essentially doing the same thing. If you try to grab a glass and you fail to do it,
you know how you often catch something, like something falls down like a glass, and you catch it before you realize you caught it?
Perfect
example. That's your animal brain at work.
Perfect example. It is exactly how a world model works. You see the glass flying, and what your brain does, it auto-completes the trajectory of the glass. It knows the physical laws of the world. It knows in a few milliseconds, the glass will be around in my hand. I will probably like put it here, close it in real time.
And it does before your prefrontal cortex even caught up.
It needs to do it faster.
Exactly. Now, I have one more thing to say about the world model stuff and about the embodiment stuff, because what will happen and what we know from the animal kingdom, for example, is like your world model will depend on your body shape. The world model of a spider is very different than the world model from a fly. It's very different than the world model from a bat.
Absolutely.
It's very different from the world model from a human.
Also, and
it's
like sensory apparatus.
100%.
And it's like eight eyes.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, just read like "What Is It Like to Be a Bat" by what was it, Thomas Nagel or something?
Yes.
However the guy was called. But like we've known this for a long time, and like just think about, let's say you want to learn about water. If you are a warship, your view of water will be very different, or like a speedboat or whatever, or like a submarine, doesn't matter. If you put a brain into a submarine and let it learn what water is and how it behaves, it's very different from a tiny, 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 like microscopic insect that lives inside like a droplet of water, or on the outside of droplets of water.
On the order of magnitude of water.
Yeah, like exactly. The water tension suddenly becomes insanely important, and all those kind of things. It's completely unimportant for like a submarine or like a, you know, a tanker and so on. And I think that will be fascinating, because I think it's unavoidable that we'll have humanoid robots, like too many people are working on it. We'll have specialized robots as well, and we'll have, you know, like robots that will probably look a little bit like spiders, like window cleaning or whatever, like I don't know what. And so they'll have different world models in terms of, so you, in the end, what I'm trying to say is like you can't run away from values, because basically like your shape dictates what you will have to value about the world in some sense, you know, what is actually important for you.
Yes.
Yeah, so that will be interesting. Will be interesting to see. But again, like back to cognitive science, like all the 4E cognitive scientists people will tell you all about this.
It's so funny that we're just basically recreating everything that we've learned about the brain in the last 20, 30 years, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it all comes back.
And it all comes back to the inherent trade-offs of how to interact and be in touch with reality. And I think this will get very metaphysical.
Let's go.
but in the end, you can't run away. There's a great book. It's called The Blind Spot. And so what's funny about physics right now, or it has been for a long while, we have two edges of physics, right? Quantum physics, relativity. Both depend to some degree on the observer.
Yes.
And so what this tells us, I'm like compressing a lot now, but that our view of reality is out of necessity participatory. So you can't remove the observer and have the God's eye view of reality. And like it comes back to the world models as well. It's like it depends on who you are, where you are, how fast you're going, and so on.
Observation is action.
Yeah, exactly.
You cannot look at something without touching it.
Exactly.
Your finger needs to push the thing in order to feel it.
Exactly.
And even the photon arriving in your eye was at some point reflected off an object.
Yeah,
so
that
photon interacted with the object itself.
And from the photon's point of view, zero time has passed.
I don't know what that means.
A photon has no time.
It moves at the speed of light.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't have time.
No, but that's what I mean. It's like from the point of view, zero time has passed. From the point of view of the photon, like it just happened.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing, right? It all comes together. It all comes together.
It's just incredible.
Yeah.
It is like...
Yeah, and like you say, I mean, again, like evolution of the brain, and like the evolutionary process that we are participating in figured all this out, and now we are rebuilding it. And also, like, you know, just to talk about kind of the current AI psychosis and the structures people build, organizations are cognitive machines that deal with these trade-off relationships as well. And there's a reason why we have hierarchies and different responsibilities and all this kind of stuff. And we are in the process of rebuilding those kind of hierarchies and systems just in an agentic world. I think that should be obvious to anyone who is...
There is like this, you know, I ask myself, do we rebuild nature because it's the inspiration for all the things that we make? Or, and, is nature just the best optimized system that we have?
Nature found what
and
works.
And it found the best solutions already for us.
So however...
It like converged to the same solution.
However, there is a difference between a bird and a jet. So there's multiple ways to do things. They all use, they both figured out the same physical principles.
But we still build humanoid bots, right? We build bots in our image, whereas it's, a bot with eight legs is probably the most optimal way to move.
I think there, like, science fiction is to blame for that to some degree. But to make a generous argument for all the road people out there, the world we have built and like, take Amazon warehouses or whatever. Like, the stuff that we've built is purpose-built for humans, for humanoids. So it makes sense to replace the existing human, like, meat and skin robots that are in an Amazon warehouse with something that, like, doesn't need to go pee, you know?
That's probably true, but I think we will, you know, see also many things that will surprise us. So will see... Maybe in warfare, that, you know, where this question about, like, you don't need any kind of connection to the thing, it doesn't need to fit in your humanoid worldview or something like that, whereas maybe the war machine will be something like a dog or like a spider that you
I mean, we see it already, drones, right? Drone warfare, it's not a Terminator-style robot that comes and kills you, it's a fucking suicide drone. So, like, we're living through that already.
The last thing that you will see.
Yeah, pretty much, and it's live stream. Great. Brave new world. Brave new world. Let's end on a positive note.
Okay. Let's try.
So, what was the most hopeful thing outside? Like, we talked to a lot of people. We saw a lot of stuff.
Yes.
The last 10 days or so. What is something that gives you hope for the future? I have my answer already. But I want to hear it.
I'm ambivalent of my answer. Because, like, what gives me the most hope is the uplifting of human spirit through these developments. Right now in the world, there are more people than ever who realize that they can do more than they thought that they can do. And I think that's the biggest, like, human level upgrade that we've seen for a long time. It is, like, I've seen so many non-technical people who suddenly build things that I, as a coder, even kind of like have a blockade in my head. I'm like thinking, how would I even start building this project? And I see, like, a non-coding person build this incredibly complex dashboard, and in my head it's like, wow, like, how did this even work? How can they keep working on it after 3 months and this is not complete spaghetti and, like, blah blah blah, all these things that I thought, like, you need a computer science degree and blah blah blah.
So no,
I
think it's just the willpower. So for high agency people, it's the best time to be alive.
It is incredible. Yeah. And I think that is something that, you know, I hope, maybe not in terms of GDP impact that we will see, but probably we will, but just in terms of how much you believe that you can do. And I think that's one of the most powerful things, because we need to surprise ourselves with the things that we can do. So that is the great equalizer of the abilities. And that gives me incredible hope. I'm just so happy that many, many more people are joining the high agency kind of pack of people who know that they can change the world.
Yeah, you can just do things. And you have, like, uncountable amount of superpowers at your fingertips right now.
It is just incredible.
Yeah. I'll give you my answer. Please. Briefly. So, obviously, I have to say Bitcoin and I have to say Nostr, but it's literally true. It gives me a ton of hope. I know everyone's bearish and depressed, but that's just, like, because everyone's retarded. And it's amazing. It's amazing that Bitcoin exists and is alive and well and works and scales and does all the things. And that we have it, and that it provides, you know, for me, it's the thing, for me, even with all the AI hype, to me, Bitcoin is still the most important thing, because what we are facing is lots of our troubles are of economic nature.
Yes.
And I think Bitcoin is literally the antidote. Like, I've always thought that, still think that.
Yeah.
Gives me a lot of hope. It's still around. It won't go anywhere. I don't think it has any big issues or big problems or anything like that. On a Nostr, obviously, like, we talked a lot about it with the, I just told you before we started recording, my setup, like, NIP 17 only, every agent just has an MPAP. I don't use anything else. I'm in the fully permissionless world always have been.
This podcast goes right to your agent through Noster. It will be uploaded.
Exactly, exactly.
It's
like, yeah, that's just like all this stuff already works. And on the AI side, shout out to Austin. He did a lot of measurements and research on this and explained this really well to me. The local models are actually catching up, getting better, getting smaller. It gives me so much hope, because I was a bit of an AI doomer in the beginning, because I was like, okay, everything was centralized, everything would be terrible. Uh-huh. Maybe let's walk up here. It might be a little bit more quiet. Let's see. Let's end up there.
Okay.
And it's just like, if you look at the graphs, where things are going, every single fucking smartphone, even old hardware potentially, will have extremely smart, extremely small models that are extremely powerful. That's where things are trending. It's undeniable. And that just gives me all the hope in the world, because it's like, this stuff will just be free and available to basically anyone who cares to use it. So it's amazing. Best time to be alive.
Best time to be alive. Once in a lifetime.
Yeah, let's see. Let's see. Let's not jinx it. Let's see where things are in 6 months from now. It's weird times. It's weird times. So the one prediction I can make is, I'm sure it will remain to be interesting. I'm sure that volatility will come in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm sure that, or I hope that we'll do this again sometime soon, next time I see you. Let's see where Cashier is.
Thank you, Gigi.
I appreciate it as well. Big hug.
Big hug.
Thanks for making the time. We'll go sleep now. I'm still sleep deprived as fuck.
It's still bright here outside in the middle of the night. Bye.
Yeah, well, no wonder I'm tired. Guess how late it is?
Oh.
Let's call it 1:21.
1:21.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.